try to check that out.
Yeah, because it looks, if I read the current law, it is optional. They don't need to send them to you.
Correct.
And yet...
And it's just those that are being sent to us that we have concern about in terms of the testimony here. We don't maintain data on the ones that aren't, you know, the ones that are evaluated in the community.
Yeah, I guess what I'm trying to do, Mr. Chairman, is just get some feeling for whether or not, even though they're 0-for-64 and sending folks to you, whether or not that represents a very large number of all the folks who are evaluated, and whether or not this is a big deal. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Dr.
Thank you.
Ben.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dale Penn. I represent the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I apologize for not having written testimony on this. I didn't realize it was up today, and I heard about it, and I wanted to say something about it. I signed up as being against the bill, but I'm kind of half for and half against, and so there wasn't a maybe there, so I checked against. I don't see any problem.
I wish we had that button.
That's the blue one.
That's the blue one.
I don't have any difficulty with the procedure that the state mental health division is proposing. In fact, that's the procedure that my county has used for this kind of examination for the last 10 years. And Representative Miller is correct that the 64 or 84 in the last 3 years is not all of them. However, we have only done in the last 4 years less than 10 dangerous offender examinations over that period of time. I have some reason to expect that that may increase in the future. We must understand that a dangerous offender status happens after conviction, and it only applies to a conviction for an A felony or another felony that involves extreme danger or injury to people. So it's those person's crimes kind of thing. And by definition, we're talking about the most dangerous offenders that we have in our system. What the statute allows is the court to, based upon the facts that the court has heard, the court may appoint a psychiatrist to do an examination and to write a report to the court to advise the court on whether or not this person has a severe personality disorder. Not that they're mentally ill, and none of these people should be mentally ill. They are antisocial personality people. They know the rules, but they don't want to obey them. And so by definition, they are extremely dangerous people. And that there is a likelihood that they will basically reoffend in the future. If the court finds that, makes a specific finding at the time of sentencing, it allows the court to increase the sentence up to a maximum of 30 years for an A felony, and, by definition, allows the court to increase the mandatory minimum up to a 15-year mandatory minimum before parole. Now, the parole board can override that mandatory minimum and can reduce the sentence. One of the kickers, though, and the reason why I think this may tend to increase its use in the future is that the parole board, at least to this point, has not fooled around with two sentences, the mandatory gun minimum, which they can't override, and dangerous offender status. It requires a psychological clearance for this individual before the person is to be paroled. So if you have a severely dangerous offender and you want to ensure that the public is going to be protected as long as possible and at least there'll be some double checking on this individual before he is paroled, the dangerous offender status becomes very important. So I think that it may increase. The procedure, then, of not mandating bringing the person to Salem, I don't think anyone opposes that. As I've said, we have always contracted with a local psychiatrist, even though here we are in Salem, it's very easy to transport the person down to the state hospital. We would simply make an appointment, psychiatrists would go to the jail, analyze the person, and then submit a report. What has been happening in the last 2 years is that case law states that the defendant may refuse to say anything at one of these examinations. And so, in the last 18 months, I have never had a defendant say anything. In fact, we had one of these examinations Saturday on a guy. I was looking at the jail log, and I saw that the psychiatrist came in at 8:15 on Saturday morning, and he left at 8:20. Because what happens is, the guy says, my attorney says I don't want to talk to you, so goodbye. And so the psychiatrist says, okay, thank you very much, and goodbye. And that's the examination, and that's the way they are all turning into this kind of bit of a charade. However, the court is still allowed to do the exam, or the psychiatrist is still allowed to do the exam, and he'll base it upon the evidence of the case, prior case history, past pre-sentence reports, that type of thing. And the Supreme Court in the last month, in two major decisions on dangerous offender, has ratified the concept and has set some guidelines on using dangerous offender examinations. So it is something that is a very important sentencing tool. The procedure here, I think, is fine and something everyone can live with and can help out the mental health division if we just pull out this idea of shipping someone to Salem for him to simply say, I don't want to talk to you. And then we have the transportation back and forth and that those kinds of expenses. The problem that I have with it is this statute predates, is an ancient statute, and it predates the state takeover of the court system. And so when it was written, it mandated that the county where this person is being prosecuted shall pay the expenses. That's because at that time the county paid all the expenses for that court system. This was part of the court's budget. The court appointed the psychiatrist. The court paid the bill. And I do not have the authority as district attorney to pick my psychiatrist. I can make suggestions, but this is a court-appointed expert. This is not a defense or a state expert. This is a court-appointed expert. So my one concern is that if we leave this to say the county shall pay, well, who is that? And I'm very frightened that eventually it comes down to Mr. District Attorney, county budget. And that's what scares me. So I think that, and I know Mr. Linden is going to object to this, but I would rather see this as a state expense because it's a court-appointed expense. Let's get rid of these expensive transportations to the state hospital, reduce them to the examination in the county where it happens. That's going to cut the cost of these things. But let's have it be a state expense because we aren't talking about big amounts of money on a statewide basis, but we are talking about the most dangerous people we deal with. And we have a real interest in making sure that the public is protected. And these are the people we should spend the money on if we're going to spend it.
Well, Mr. Linden has signed up to testify, but I notice he didn't mark either for or against, so he didn't venture out. I mean, I guess I'm a little bit, the indication from the previous testimony was that the mental health division has in fact not been charging, the state hospital hasn't been charging for these services to counties. One of your concerns, I take it, is that they would start doing this because of that Crawford question. But I'm wondering, Dr. Mazur, would you mind coming back up for a minute, and don't leave Mr. Penn, but I'm going to ask a dumb question. Some people say there aren't such things, but I'm convinced there are. In your testimony, Doctor, you said that none of the evaluation showed that the individuals had a major mental illness. And then Mr. Penn was talking about severe personality disorders. Do you consider severe personality disorders to be a mental illness? Are we just using terms here that are not something that is a problem, or?
No, I would agree with Mr. Penn's characterization of the mental health part of this. Personality disorders are not classified as major mental illness, but rather characterological defects, as Mr. Penn indicated, that are based on poor learning history and prior experience, and are individuals
who understand the law and should be able to constrain their behavior according to it, but for some reason don't or choose not to.
Then the kind of evaluation that goes on where an individual doesn't respond to questions, it would be very difficult to determine whether or not a person had any even a severe personality disorder. So I'm wondering if, in fact, these 64 cases just basically were events, not events.
No, what happens then is, as Mr. Penn indicated, it's allowed to review, it is, the law allows a review of the record in making that determination. And so what the psychologists, psychiatrists do is to return to the record and have to base the judgment entirely on the record rather than any self-report of the individual brought for evaluation, which also leads, as indicated in the testimony, to some problems because we don't always have access to all the criminal records that are housed in the county where the person came from. Sometimes those aren't brought to us. So that's another glitch that's possible in transporting people back and forth when the records don't get transported with them.
Do you consider the evaluations that you're doing, and I got some impression, Dale, maybe that you were saying that this provides a double check. I think you mentioned that one time, sort of a double checking of the situation where a county may do an evaluation and then further send it to you, or is this a single point of contact?
We do not use the state hospital in these examinations. We simply have a local provider go to the jail to do that, and other counties do follow the statute and send the person down to Salem.
Questions? Representative Miller?
Well, following up on your last comment, Dale, you said other statutes do send them on down there. It still appears to me that currently it's just an option.
Right. That's true.
Is there a problem if we eliminate the option? Why would somebody send them down there as opposed to doing it like you do?
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. I believe that this procedural change, there's nothing wrong with it, and that's fine. I think it's a waste of everyone's time and Mental Health Division resources to have this in the statute where maybe people look at it and say, well, we should send them down to Salem because it says this. It can be done in the local environment. And I think that's a good procedure. That, like I say, that's what we've been doing for the last 10 years. My only concern is who ends up ultimately paying for it.
I would agree, Mr. Chairman, that it's maybe more appropriate to do it locally, but is there any reason that they send them there instead of doing it locally and that we'd be wrong in taking away the option?
I think
who sends them down there? Representative Springer had a good question. Who are the offending counties, or the not necessarily offending, but who does it the most? Mm-hmm. Maybe we need to ask those folks why they can't use the local resources as you do.
I think it really, without inquiring of everyone, I think it's a situation where the statute says, and you may send them down to the, it has a whole procedure there. And 20 years ago when this statute was written, it made a lot of sense why to do that, because the experience and the expertise in dealing with that kind of offender was concentrated in Salem and the Oregon State Hospital. And you may not have someone in the locality in Eastern Oregon or in Roseburg or something who'd done with or dealt with this kind of offender. I don't think that's true anymore. And certainly in doing the kind of examinations for mental disease defenses, we haven't concentrated at all in just using state hospital people. There are people throughout the state that can do those examinations. These are somewhat similar, although they really branch off into different issues.
One other, if I might, Mr. Chair, and that is, I think you said you'd sent 10 down there.
Trying to think back, probably in the last 4 years, we've only done about 10 examinations. We have not sent them to the hospital. Those are ones that we've done in our county. We haven't, to my knowledge, we haven't sent anyone to the hospital for this kind of examination for years.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Penn, if the state were to take responsibility for all AMB felons under what would have been Senate Bill 808 last session, would that resolve this issue?
It may or may not, because if I don't recall that statute. If it's after they're sentenced, this is a pre-sentence kind of thing, but that might be an easy way to do it. All A and B felonies, if this is a part of the procedure that would be handled by the state, that would be fine.
Okay, fine. Thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Linden.
For the record, Bill Linden, State Court Administrator. Mr. Penn hit it right on the head. We don't have any particular concern with the concept here of conducting these examinations in the locales as opposed to shipping folks to Salem. However, we do have an interest in seeing that the present system, whereby the counties are responsible for payment, is kept in place. The major argument that I see in favor of that is look at the nature of the proceeding and whose interests are served by it. As Mr. Penn mentioned, if the defendant is found to be a dangerous offender, both the mandatory minimum and the maximum sentence can be increased. And that is an interest that is clearly a prosecution interest as opposed to a defense interest. So if the cost were to be shifted to the state, and again, remembering that 80% roughly of the criminal defendants are found to be indigent and the expense of providing them services are paid out of the Indigent Defense Fund, you would be in a position of having the Indigent Defense Fund paying for a service which is not necessarily in the interest of the defendant. I think that it's consistent to have the counties responsible for this cost as opposed to the State Indigent Defense Fund or the Judicial Department itself. And again, the reason is that what does this examination do within the system? And what it does basically is provide the judge with a rationale for enhancing the penalty that the defendant could receive. So it's clearly not in the defendant's benefit. As far as the local examination option, we've encouraged our courts in other proceedings, such as fitness to proceed hearings, to conduct those exams locally as often as they can, because there are expenses that are avoided if that's done. The sheriffs don't have to transport people to the state hospitals. And on the point of conducting dangerous offender exams locally, we have no objection with that aspect of it.
Thank you, Mr. Lennon. Do you have any idea how many cases may have come from what counties? Do you have any sense of figures on that?
Mr. Chairman, I don't, although I would be happy to work with the other witnesses and see if we can't come up with a breakdown on a county-by-county basis as to where these people are coming from and why they're coming. I know I've had a couple of judges in Eastern Oregon remark on fitness to proceed hearings that sometimes they've had difficulty finding psychiatric professionals locally who are willing to do the work for the amount of money that they can pay them. But I'll be happy to work with the other folks to find out.
Representative Ballin.
I'm curious, and maybe I should have asked the witness before you, but do you know the number of felons who've been sentenced since 1984 as dangerous offenders?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bauman, I don't know the answer to that. I know that in our statistical system, we wouldn't keep that data. However, I would think that in the corrections division statistics, they may have data on how many dangerous offenders are in the system at any given time.
I have a follow-up question. Just curious about the impact of controlling cost or sentencing patterns and how cost comes into that. It seems to me that it might make more sense to have the state court administrator be administering the budget for this program, since control over who's using the program or not is in the hands of judges. And I just want to hear your response to that in terms of just the policy that sets up, whereas otherwise judges who are directly under the state court administrator, at least their budget is there, their policies may be there, are responsible for administering a portion of what's essentially the county's budget.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bauman, the difficulty I have with that concept is I don't have any control over whether or not a judge is going to order one of these exams unless the statute were amended to say subject to financial limitations imposed by the state court system, a judge may order these examinations. As the system presently sits, if the court finds that this examination would be beneficial to their sentencing process, they can order that. Unless there were almost an unlimited amount of funds to be devoted to these hearings, we get in the position of probably having to mandate to judges that they don't order these if it's going to take them beyond the amount of money that's available, and I'm not certain that we necessarily want to do that. We've had, it could be that the State Indigent Defense Board is in a better position to respond to that, because under law right now, they have the authority to put certain limits and standards into the compensation for expenses, or not really expenses, but for fees in the indigent defense system. But to get back and try and summarize my response to your central question, I don't think, absent some statutory limitation that we can turn off the faucet when we run out of money, that we're going to have any control over how many of these exams trial judges decide to order.
I
further question?
Yeah, I guess it just seems really important to me to have some idea where these exams are coming from and what the result of them is and what the subsequent sentencing pattern is, since I really do believe, looking at it, that the primary usefulness is enhancing something that you said, which is provides the judge with a rationale for enhancing the sentence.
Well, as I mentioned, I'll be happy to work with the other witnesses to come up with that data.
Further questions, Representative Sprayer?
Bill, I just want to make sure I tracked on your point about the what you call the fitness to proceed, or what I'm thinking of, what I call aid and assist. You're talking about the same thing, basically. How many, did you say that you folks are now on the cuff for paying for those, or how are those handled now?
Well, we have encouraged, Mr. Representative Springer, we have encouraged judges to pay or to hold those hearings locally as opposed to shipping them off to one of the state institutions. My recollection is that the expense of those is divided right now. There could be some cost to the sheriff if there's transportation of the person involved, in other words, bringing that person into Salem. But as far as the actual psychiatric examination expense, that's a cost of the Indigent Defense Fund.
Okay.
Those exams are typically conducted at the request of defense counsel or on the court's own motion.
Further question, Representative Schreier?
I don't know if this gets back to the doctor's concern, whether or not they are getting requests to aid or to perform exams for this aid and assist issue right at the front end of a trial or judicial process, or if it's your sense that some people are transported to Salem for that purpose, or that you encourage those exams to be done locally?
Representative Springer, within the last 3 to 4 months, the Chief Justice, I know, has at least once reminded trial courts of the desirability of conducting those exams locally, as opposed to the added expense to everybody in the system of shipping them to Salem.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Linden. You may just want to stay right there. Is there anyone else who wishes to be heard on this bill? Okay. Yes, I thought I'd keep it for the next bill, but.
I'm Mike Hansen, and I'm the administrator for the Indigent Defense Fund, and I want to join the Me Too parade at this point on the issue of funding. Simply want to make the point, I guess, again, that it certainly is not in the defendant's interest to be found to be dangerous. And in determining the principle of who should pay, it would seem to me that only those expenses related to aiding the defendant ought to be billed to the Indigent Defense Fund. So my primary concern at this point is simply not to see the Indigent Defense Fund become a catch-all budget to pay for these other expenses. So I encourage you to do is to either leave the legislation like it is, or at least clearly identify who is responsible to pay for these various expenses. I have some comments, if I may, Representative Springer, regarding the aid and assist examination. We've been going through a process of trying to cut our expenses where we can. And there has been a concerted effort, I think, in coordination in Bill's office with one of his legal counsel in the Oregon State Hospital to do a couple of things. One has been to reduce the cost of those agent-assisted examinations by keeping those people who are subject to the examinations on an outpatient basis, and so we avoid hospital expenses, and you avoid overnight stays, which all add to the cost. And that's been, I think, a pretty successful program. And the second thing that has been done has been, again, to encourage local courts through a set of fairly elaborate, I think, guidelines and reminders to use local psychiatrists or psychologists as opposed to sending defendants automatically to the state hospital. The experience, last time I think I checked on it a few months ago, was pretty good. There was a good response, and the number of exams at the state hospital had declined. We're continuing to work on that. Certainly there are benefits to us in terms of reducing costs, benefits to the hospital in terms of preserving scarce resources. So we're working on that.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Questions? Do you have a question?
I'm just baffled, and I guess what I hear happening, I'm trying to get a check on what I hear happening here, and that is that up to now, all of these examinations have been conducted for judges who've sent defendants down to be evaluated by the mental health division without any charges being made to anybody, state, indigent defense, or counties.
Well, except Representative Bauman, anytime you take up someone's time to conduct that within the health, the hospital, that is a charge. That, in fact, is a charge that's been incurred, I would assume.
But that's been absorbed by the mental health division and has not been passed on anywhere else in the system to any of the.
Yeah, my point is that you don't simply absorb.
I realize that. So what we're looking at is the savings to the mental health division, and a charge to someone else, and we're trying to finger who someone else is going to be.
And I believe Dr. Mazur testified that what the hospital was going to start doing was now charging back to the counties. In any case, that being the case, at this point, the charges would go back to the county, even if the state conducted the examination, which is Mr. Penn's concern. And your concern is that it should be, well, we're getting into it.
A little too far, but the result is
concern that we were noted here, obviously, and we will. Mr. Linden, do you have a comment on that?
Just a very quick comment, Mr. Chairman. I think it's a classic situation where there's been authority for the state through the Mental Health Division to charge back. It hasn't been done. It's going to start happening now. The counties, through the DAs, are suggesting they don't want to begin to absorb that cost, and a couple of us on the state side are saying we don't want to absorb it either. So you're right in characterizing that it's a little bit of a don't do it to me, do it to him kind of a deal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hansen. Anyone else wishes to be heard on House Bill 2158? If not, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2158. Before I open the hearing on the next bill, let me point out to members of the committee, there's a sheet you have in front of you which has a schedule and ways and means on it. And there are some things circled on there, February 2nd through the week of the 6th. That circle says Military Department, but it's an indication from. You have one?
Maybe yeah. Didn't get that. Must have let me caught on with something else.
There's a. That circle because the chairman of that subcommittee. Indicated there may be that may be the dates that they're trying to look for a visit to Eastern Oregon Correctional Institute. And the other dates that are circled down there, March 2nd through 6th and 9th through 13th, are the dates that they'll be doing the workups and possibly site visits on the corrections budget. And I thought you might want to be aware of that, of those dates. And lots of other things you might want to be aware of. Okay. We'll open a hearing now on House Bill 2179. Linden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2179 was pre-session filed at the request of the Judicial Department and relates to our ability in the state court system to recover monetary obligations imposed on criminal defendants. courts have always imposed fines on and collected fines and costs from criminal defendants. And these monies typically go to the benefit of the state general fund, or sometimes by law they're dispersed out to local governmental entities. In recent years, there's been a trend to allow courts in the criminal process to impose money sanctions beyond fines and costs to include such things as fees, for example, the conviction fees on DOII, assessments. Another example would be the victims assessment program, and miscellaneous costs and disbursements like recoupment of attorney's fees. Prior to state funding, each county would handle the collection of these monies however they felt was best for their local circumstance. Since state funding, we've been involved in an effort to standardize the approach for collecting these monies that criminal defendants owe. And 2179 is our attempt to bring together the last few pieces that we feel we need in the statutory framework in order to do this in a comprehensive and standard manner. 2179 does a number of basic things. First of all, it includes in statute all of the various types of money sanctions that a court can impose on a criminal defendant, so on a convicted criminal defendant. So it brings together in one section the various fines, costs, disbursements, recoupment, etc.